ahead and get us started. It's 5:02. This is the July 18th pre-council session. Go ahead and call us to order. I know that Councilmember Wainer is not going to be here tonight, so we have all the remaining council members here. DeCarlin, first up is our Lester Woods Jr. Transportation Initiative.
Yes, ma'am. So Dr. Woods is going to give a quick presentation. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Take it away.
Thank you. Good. I guess it's still afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I am Lester Woods, and I am actually a local pastor here in Columbia, Missouri, Urban Empowerment Ministries. And just want to first off thank the council for the opportunity to present here today. So to all the council members, thank you so much. To Mayor Buffalo, thank you. And of course, to Mr. Seawood, we really appreciate you. And let me also thank Carol for helping get me scheduled and set up to talk to you all today. So it's really a pleasure to have an opportunity to talk, I guess I should say, about what we're calling a dynamic opportunity to do first mile, last mile type of transportation services to those who specifically need access to workplace and our other basic needs and transportation opportunities.
So, is there any way to get up and speak out so people can hear you back in the
room? Yeah, we were trying to rectify that. I have some notes, but I don't mind standing. I'll have to kind of hold my folder here. Would that work okay?
Yeah.
As long as you're good. Also, we have our microphones, so we're also recording as well. So you're good. You can see it. It's great. Right? That little black robot and mouse looking thing.
All right. I'll try to do this right here. Would this help?
Yes.
And as a pastor, I bet you can.
I can project.
Project.
All right. Let me also just—I see a lot of familiar faces here as well. Some of those who I've seen in different conferences and meetings, and are working with in a lot of different areas. So we really appreciate the opportunity to make this presentation to you. I want to just kind of start a little bit talking about the SOURCE Summit. And I mentioned the SOURCE Summit because it is the avenue by which it is that a SOURCE Summit roundtable, a group of individuals who are working with us on different issues in the community surrounding social and economic concerns, have kind of convened and come together to try to address some of the things that we've been dealing with here within our community. Let me also acknowledge, first off, our SOURCE Summit leadership. While I'm kind of the convener of the whole initiative, I do have a couple of our leadership that is with us today, and that is DeAndre Thompson right here, as well as Shannon Wilson. I think I saw her come in somewhere back here. She's over there working with us on our leadership. And then in the roundtable, there are a number of other entities and organizations that have been participating with us as well. And a lot of them are city employees and city workers. So for those who are here, if you don't mind, can you stand? Because I would be a fear of missing somebody. Can you stand or just wave your hand at least so we can just acknowledge them? So thanks to all of them for being here this afternoon as well. So first slide. The SOURCE Summit, I started about a year or so ago, just kind of what I call convening and pulling together a number of faith-based leaders, community leaders with community-based organizations, as well as just corporations, people who have opportunities for jobs and are might contract with individuals to talk about how we can address some of the economic and social concerns within our community. And the intent of this whole ideal is simply just to bring together the community stakeholders and work together to close economic gaps within disparate communities and just bridge those gaps with relationships with others that are have opportunities to provide. The biggest thing and the benefit, I think, about the whole SOURCE Summit initiative is that while many of us talk about economic and social concerns, civil rights, social justice issues, equity, disparities all the time, I think one of the things that have been missing for quite a while in some of these discussions is the faith-based community. So I think the specialty around the SOAR Summit and the ideal of the vision of it is to really bring the faith-based community back into the conversation of how it is that we develop and how we address people of color and those who are disadvantaged and help them have a better quality of life. And so as a consequence of that, we are providing tools and resources for the faith-based community to more easily contract and engage with city government, county government, state government, and others who have those types of opportunities. And then I guess I'd just say that, again, this really is about trying to address workforce concerns, trying to address business concerns, and just trying to address some of the other social concerns that we might see within our community. Next slide. And the philosophy of the whole summit perspective is kind of what I call the three-pronged bilateral approach. Basically, we're just saying that how can faith-based community, businesses, corporations, hiring entities, and community-based organizations intentionally collaborate, partner together to address the other pronged issues that I discussed, education, employment, as well as entrepreneurship. How can the faith-based community be a part of that conversation and how can we address those things? So the whole idea behind the SOAR Summit was not just to hold a nice event, which we did in November 2021. And I want to thank City Manager Seawood and others who are here who helped and were a part of that. Reddy, and I look around the room, Reverend Gray, who I call him the community pastor. Many of you all were a part of that initiative and really, really, I think, helped to provide some healthy dialogues and conversations. As a result of those, what we have done since November 2021 is we didn't stop with just a nice event. We have convened around 30 or so community leaders to continue the dialogue from the November summit and drill down into addressing those issues and those concerns that we've come up with. And just to highlight a few of those things that we were concerned about is childcare. We're concerned about elderly care. We're concerned about workforce development, jobs, employment. We're concerned about the unsheltered population within our community, as well as we're concerned about gun violence, youth violence, and of course, transportation, which is the discussion that we're having here tonight. But overall, we checked a few boxes. We convened some very collaborative, informative meetings. We are right now working on what I call a community partnering agreement. And I think that community partnering agreement is very important because what it will do is define roles, responsibilities, and objectives for all of the players that are at this roundtable. That's important so that nobody is, you know, overstepping or overreaching into areas of opportunities that somebody else is already working on. But we can have a pretty clear alignment of what it is that we can do to address those core items that I just discussed. And the biggest thing out of that, I think, is not only the community partner agreement, but it is the community action initiatives. And there are four of them that we've so far, and we've had four meetings, one in January 2022, we had one in April, we had one in June. And then we had some breakout meetings with the transportation initiative that I'm going to talk about more specifically. But there's four core items that this group has decided to work on. Number one, the gun buyback program. Again, if we're going to address youth violence, gun violence, you know, I'm not saying that this is the overall fix to it, but it is something that we think is an opportunity for all of us to think about critically and work on. One of the presenters that we had this past summit in November 2021 was a pastor out of Chicago. His name is Corey Brooks. And Corey Brooks right now is still what he calls on the roof. He's what they call the rooftop pastor, where he is across the street from his church. He sat on the roof of an old hotel and raised money to buy that land and to tear that old hotel down. And they did that several years ago. And now, since he left our summit in November, he has gone back on the roof, and he's been in the process of raising millions of dollars to build a community center. But one of the things that we learned from him is that in juxtaposition to that community center, the different types of things that they're doing there, is that you got to try to get the guns off the street. And so he's got a process that he's utilizing. So we're trying to glean some things from him about their gun buyback program. Reverend Gray is here today, and he's been at our round table. And one of the things that he brought up, while we have a number of people at the round table trying to address the issues and the needs within the community, how about the members of the round table go and do what we call a bus tour and just travel around to the different areas within the city, see where the pockets of poverty are, see where the food deserts are, see where there's been different issues of violence and that type of thing, so that the people that are at this round table can really know and understand logistically and geographically where some of these concerns are and how we can do some things to address them. So we're in the process of developing that somewhere around August or September. The community partner agreement, I talked about that one. And then flat on the table, it fell upon us that the biggest issue of concern that we needed to try to address first, while we can walk and chew gum at the same time, we really need to try to address this issue of transportation. Through one of our friends that is in the room today, of course, I think Stacey Budden is back here ready, and Lisa's been working very closely with me and Bernie. But they introduced me to a young lady named Judy Garcia, who is actually here today as well. And she's in human resources at Swift Prepared Foods, and they're now building a big facility on Route B. And Judy introduced me to about 7 or 8 of the employers there on Route B. And many of them that I had a chance to have this discussion with told me that their greatest barrier to recruitment and retention is getting people back and forth to work to Route B. It's their biggest barrier. Many of them are not meeting their hiring goals, although they are being able to maintain, you know, their work. But wouldn't it be awesome for all of us to be fully employed right now and have people working for us, you know, if you will? And so we're trying to help close the gap of those workforce concerns by this transportation initiative. And so that's really why we're here. I just wanted to set up a little bit of that conversation on how we got to where we were, to how we got to where we are here now. We've named this initiative the Last Mile Valet Service. The Last Mile Valet Service. Honestly, we put valet on there because, you know, I think transportation, and by the way, I'm in transportation. I've been in civil rights, social justice, and transportation-related fields for the last 20 years. And I think the way that I look at transportation through my lens is that it should not be considered, if you will, a social handout. It is an economic engine. Transportation is an economic engine. It's an opportunity for getting people not only back and forth to work and to jobs and for businesses, you know, that they're trying to run, but it's an opportunity to generate economy and not just be a handout, but a handout. And so our ideal about this 1 year right now pilot program is that basically we want to establish a baseline transportation service, not to replace anything that's already taking place within the community, but to supplement what is taking place in the community and come alongside our city transit bus line and bus services, come alongside some of our taxi services, and maybe even come alongside Uber, if you will, and Lyft and some of those other things that, those other transportation services that are in the community. Because I think what we all can agree with is that right now, financially, we don't have the capacity to meet the fullness of the need. We really don't have the capacity to meet the fullness of the need. And I'm not saying that this service that we're proposing here this afternoon will resolve all of it, But if we close the gap a little bit and scale what we have the potential of doing here, I think we can get to a place to bring it about a great change for many of those individuals who are really in dire need of transportation. And maybe, hopefully, you know, this younger generation, many of them are moving to the aspect of not even buying cars at all. And so, you know, transportation services would be a great benefit for them, not only just for getting back and forth to their jobs, but also for getting back and forth for other basic needs and services. So what we are doing, again, is a pilot program. The goal is to expand upon the current transportation services that we have now, not to replace anything, not to compete with anything, but to complete and to supplement the services that are already here. And we think that if this not be considered as an economic handout, but as an economic, rather as social handout, but as an economic engine, we can definitely get to the place of sustainability and sufficiency for that to address some of the social and economic concerns with those that are disadvantaged. I want to talk a little bit about this approach that we have for this. So the last mile transportation service, I think the roundtable and the subcommittee that is working with me on this, we all got really, really excited when several members around the table started to put in funds to make this happen really fast. While we got excited, I got also a little nervous because, you know, although well-intentioned, it's not enough. But we did have anonymous donor provide us funds, and Veterans United provided us funds to purchase three of Taxi Terry's vans in which it was that he was going out of business with. So those vans right now are sitting on our church parking lot, ready and willing and able to be used. But the purchase of the vans is not enough to get the whole program moving. And how do we intend to scale this? Because we also know that three vans is not enough to do it within itself. So that's where the faith-based community comes in, I think. As a pastor myself, and we're working with a number of pastors who have been a part of the roundtable and who attended the summit as well, many of us have vans sitting on our parking lot during the week that does not do anything but collect dust until Wednesday night and Sunday morning. I think that is a disservice to our community when we could have an organization or an entity like this that can subcontract services to the local faith-based communities and help supplement the need that we have where the gap is so that we can get people back and forth to work. And by the way, while we're getting those individuals back and forth to work, what we're also doing is providing jobs for people in those faith-based communities who will be driving those vans as well. So it is, I think, a very creative ideal and something that could be a benefit to all in our community. Again, 12-month duration, and after the one-year pilot that we're proposing here today, we would evaluate that pilot and determine how it is we would move forward. Within the transportation subcommittee, we got two groups. One is working on the pilot of this, and the other one is working on the scale of this. And you might call me crazy, but I know it's kind of unusual to be trying to develop a transportation, role in a climate where gas prices have flown through the roof. But I think that's another part of the faith-based community. So that's kind of why we're here. We're doing this, and we think that it's something that can still be a benefit. So we got three vans. We would supplement those vans with the faith-based community that can help us scale the program to meet whatever the need is. Okay. A couple of scopes in this proposal. First off, is just simply to secure contracted services with some of the employers within the community, and you'll see here in just a moment. There is a monthly fee service for providing those corporations access to the program so that we can get their employees back and forth to work. So we're working very critically and expeditiously now to try to get those some of those contractors and some of those corporations on board. Of course, the second piece of this is we've got to hire some people. All of us that are at this table now working this, even me, we're volunteering our time and volunteering our service to this. I have actually two full-time jobs, so I can't leave either of those to run this myself on a day-to-day basis, but we'll definitely oversee it and manage it. And then we have to hire the drivers and get people in those seats so that we can get them to moving. And then lastly, and maybe this doesn't have to go in this order, we can do some of them at the same time, but as we contract services with some of the vendors and those employers, we'll have to design the routes, you know, the logistics and the schedules and the pickup spots and that type of thing. We'll get that. We're actually already in the process of collecting information to get that, get those things developed. So you're probably asking, how much does this cost? These are some pretty roundabout numbers, I guess I'd say. We've never done this before. We came up with our own kind of projections and surveys for what we think it would be. The first couple of budget line items there have already been taken care of. These are the resources that we had for purchasing the vans, and we still have some money left over to take care of the marketing and branding for the vans. But the third budget item there is operational costs. We're just kind of projecting that it would take around $18,000 a year here or there to begin the operational and the maintenance of each of these current three vans that we have. We might be shooting ourselves in the foot a little bit, but at least it gives us something to start with for 1 year. The next budget line item, the $18,000, is the potential that we have for contracting out other faith-based subcontractors to supplement the three vans that we currently have. $45,000 we estimate to hire drivers. At this point, we have $15 per hour to hire drivers at about part-time of 1,000 hours per year. You know, that is going to be very much determined upon the need. And these numbers were set a couple months ago, while right now driver numbers are really ticking up quite a bit. We probably really need to be around $18 to $20 per hour to hire drivers. So we just want to make sure that we do understand that. And then lastly, budget item, about $50,000 to run an administrator. This is the person that helps, you know, the coordination, the dispatching, so on and so forth, to get the drivers in the seats out, making those points of contact. First year estimation then is around about $193,925. You can take off $27,000 of that. That was already taken care of in the first two budget line items. And so we're estimating now around about $166,925 for the first year. And this is to seed the program and to get the initiative up and going. Okay? Only just a couple more slides and then I'll be done. Now, that $166,000 or so, again, is to seed the program, to get the program up and going. But we would still estimate that we would need to have those employers who want to utilize this service to pay a monthly fee. And this is the breakdown of the estimation of the monthly fee that we come up with. And I've kind of fact-checked this and gut-checked this a little bit. I met with Veterans United. They have the Flourish program at Veterans United. And they kind of gave me a kind of eyeball on what it is that they were paying, check this out, Taxi Terry, to help transport their kids back and forth to some of their jobs and to home. And the figure that it is that they came up with is hitting right around where we were per number of employees and their students on this per monthly rate. So they were doing about 60 employees or students or so, and they were paying around $5,000 a month, mostly to Taxi Terry, to make this work for them. So I think, and I did this projection before I met with Veterans United and Forbes, so it was good to see that it came pretty much right on. Okay. Before I move on from this part right here, I want to jump the gun just a little bit and talk a little bit about what I'm coming to ask the City Council for this evening. In our subcommittee transportation conversations, I think we've all agreed that to make this work, it is really going to take public-private partnership funds. In other words, one of our Route B coalition businesses are ready to seed this project, but they have challenged me to be on the lookout for public matching funds. In other words, I don't think the private business community can do this by themselves. This will be a benefit not only to their employees, but we're looking for this to be a benefit to the total community at large. And so in my ask here this evening, and I'll tell you, the $60,000 that this one corporation is looking to seed, they're asking me to ask you to match it at $60,000 as an initial seed to get the project up and going. So that is my ask to the council. I do have one more slide, and then I'll take your questions. But I think that's reasonable. You know, I'm in transportation myself, and we see a lot of public-private types of partnerships, cost sharing, and that type of thing to make things work. And again, I don't think that this does not take away from anything that the city does with their current transit, operations that you have going. I see this as a benefit, as a supplement, and something that we can come alongside. And I know transportation costs. I'm pretty sure this is quite a bit reasonable than maybe what it is that you might be spending at the time. But that's not for me to answer. Lastly, again, we're just really kind of looking at this this 1 year pilot to expand services for employment and other basic needs, to assist riders with transportation and transitioning to maybe other transportation modes. We think we'll have a pretty captive audience as we're transporting people back and forth to work. Whereas if they desire to have other means of transportation, we'll have volunteer counselors that can help them move into those other areas. As a matter of fact, at our Transportation Initiative Roundtable, there are other transportation initiatives going on, specifically with Love Columbia. Jane Williams is a part of our roundtable, and they're doing some transportation counseling with helping individuals purchase cars. So we would be working along with them with that. My friend Andrew Grabeau is here today as well with United Way. He's been a part of our roundtable discussion since the beginning. And we're partnering with them on some initiatives for transportation as well. So again, we're not trying to do this in a silo. We're really trying to do this in an avenue that can come alongside and collaborate with other entities within our community. And then last but not least, as I mentioned earlier, we really view this transportation initiative as an economic engine and generator as opposed to just a social handout. So thank you so much, and we'll be more than happy to.
Thank you, Esther. Quick question. DeKerlin, on our agenda, I want to make sure I give enough time, but also don't take away time. What do we estimate for the next two items that are on our agenda so I know how much to give for questions?
Oh, 30 minutes?
Good
question.
Okay. Yes. Okay, so maybe like 10 minutes. Are you okay with us? Questions? Sub 10, just so we make sure. Okay. Is that okay? Then how much time for the last thing? We're good? I don't know. It's a closed part.
That one shouldn't take that long.
Okay. All right. Good. All right. So question. Thank you again for the presentation. One off question I just have to start is this a request for specific, like ARPA fund or just in general city support funding?
Yeah. So, you know, I understand that, you know, the city definitely has those ARPA funds and ARPA dollars, you know. We would be willing to accept this from whichever pot of funds that is.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I had the right hat on today. So it's ARPA discussion next. Okay.
I do think this meets the criteria of ARPA.
Oh, yeah.
I really do. And we've had funds before ARPA as well. So whichever bucket of funds.
Okay. All right, questions from council. Yeah, Nick.
Two. First, very excited about this. I mean, there's no question that it's a needed service, particularly in what you've talked about and where that is. One, and this really I think might be a sidebar, but when you mentioned Taxi Terry's, I'm aware that the city had a contract with Taxi Terry's to provide transportation for people with disabilities. Would that be a part of what you would be able to provide in this service?
Yeah, well, currently at this point, the vans that we purchased, he did have an ADA accessible van.
Uh-huh.
However, the vans that we purchased were not one of those vans. Now, this works well. We're going to have to purchase new vans at some point, and definitely it would be our consideration to accommodate those with disabilities.
And just projecting in terms of sustainability, what would you foresee in terms of funding this in an ongoing fashion? I guess specifically, would you be looking to the city to provide continuing funding over a period of time?
So I think our private partners would say that they would love to see some continuation of public funds. So to answer your question, yes, we would be very interested in continued funding from the city. However, I do think this pay schedule will be something that we can help to accommodate supplementing some of those funds continually as well.
Quick clarification on that one. Did you, when you talked about getting the gut check and feedback, was that those fees something that you heard positive response from the businesses on Route B and others?
Yeah, and I do have some of them here today as well. I think I mentioned Judy, so if any of them want to chime in, they can.
Okay.
I can't say that I specifically heard from them about how they felt about the fees. At this point, you know, we're really trying to see the program to get it up and going, and then go to scope number one, which is contracting the services.
Yeah.
But any comment?
Yeah. Carl, you got it.
Yeah, I like the basics of your presentation. I also like the idea of matching funds for the city because this is a true public-private partnership. And it's reminiscent of some of the discussions that we had about the flex service in addition to public transit service that we have. Obviously, there's always issues about public transit and how you fund it and whether we get grants and whether we continue to make it free and so on. Throw that out there, just the idea that there is the prospect of charging even for parking at the airport, because that's kind of a privileged view of transportation, and I think that probably is coming, and that could go towards thinking about funding some of these mechanisms. I think the ask $60,000 is perfectly reasonable under the circumstances. And I like the idea, particularly as with the employment situation on the Route B corridor. So, just for the record.
One thing I forgot to ask you, you call it last mile. And I know that had been discussed at a chamber event I was at one time where they talked about connecting a bus stop, you know, to the last mile. You're talking about full trip.
So, it depends.
Or last mile.
Yeah, it depends. As a matter of fact, I haven't spoken with my subcommittee about this as well. But honestly, we're really thinking of developing a first mile and last mile, which basically means depending on the situation of the individual or the contracting agency that it is that we work with, if they have a spot to pick people up from, we could work with that. But in actuality, we're trying to go to people's homes.
Mm-hmm.
And or we're trying to go from a stop to get them to that work location. This is intended to be a full service, valet service.
Okay. Did you?
So do you envision this initially starting as transportation to and from just work?
We are. Because of the funders that would be putting into it initially. But I think as we have a scale subcommittee working on this, I believe we'll scale pretty quickly because the schedule that we'll make for those corporations, I don't think will be throughout the entirety of the day. You'll get a morning run, maybe an afternoon run, maybe a night run. And so in between, with the fund, with the funding and finances available in overflow, we could utilize those services for other basic needs transportation.
How would you measure success, you know, at the end of that first year?
Yeah, if we're broke, that's one way. but individually, you know, were individuals maintained? We will evaluate where the corporations are with their hiring practices and determine, were they able to scale up in hiring individuals beyond what they were before, and were they able to retain those individuals would be a couple components. Another component I see us having is that were any of those individuals, did they move from utilizing these services to maybe even purchasing some of their own vehicles and the transportation avenues? So 4 or 5 items I think we can select as goals.
But not numbers of people served?
We will surely track and calculate numbers of individuals served, absolutely.
Right, but yeah, I mean, you have goals or targets for first year, what you think might be achievable?
We do not have that on first year, but first year becomes a benchmark. So as we benchmark and understand what the capacity is, those numbers will begin to generate for us to calculate second, third, and fourth years.
Yeah. Well, it does sound like, particularly in terms of transportation to employment centers, that this falls under the category of workforce development.
That's what I was thinking too.
I guess I know that it's come up before in terms of government funding for, you know, non-government transportation, about like you know, requiring ADA compliance and things like that. So I don't know the particulars on that. And then I know, I guess this is probably more of a legal question, but just because you mentioned partnering with, you know, different faith-based organizations, and, you know, if there's any lines that we need to be careful about with government funding or government partnership with specific faith-based organizations. So,
I understand. Point taken. And I will say that, you know, I do understand from Taxi Terry as well as some of the other transportation providers is that the insurance of this is pretty astronomical.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we will be, of course, fully insured. And I have heard from some of our faith-based organizations a little bit of pushback from getting their vehicles, if you will, involved due to liability concerns. But that's not all of them. That's just a few.
Right.
And so we're going to work through that issue to make sure we select the ones that will be accountable and able to come to.
Right. Well, I'm thinking more of it from a government funding perspective. If you do it, you know, for one organization, then it, you know, it has to be for any organization that would want to do it.
Like how we had to go out for an RFP for the bids for the ADA taxis, and then have Taxi Terry be responding to
government choosing one faith versus another.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. So I think I understand your concern, Matt. I think that after the first year, if we continue our funding of this initiative, then there would be an RFP process and they would apply for it. Just like we have organizations that have faith components in cooperation with churches that come in for CDBG and home funds and other social service funds. So I think that there's a lot of smart people in this town that know how to navigate that already, including some city staff. I see you nodding your head there. Where is Stacy Button?
Is she here? She's in the corner.
Okay. Stacy, it was a year ago this week that I was in your offices at your invitation with Moberly Area Community College, with Job Point, with the Chamber, talking about how do we get employees out there to Swift Foods and other employers who have jobs for them. So I'm sorry it's taken us this long to get here, but this was the very thing we were talking about in that small group, including the fact that we need to meet their transportation needs first mile and last mile. So I'm very positive on your proposal. I'm going to say something that will make the rest of the people in the room crazy, and that is
I don't know that you've asked us for enough money to be successful in getting this up and running. I'm concerned about, as I've already spoken to you about, $15 an hour. You know, people have second jobs because they need a second job, not because they have free time. And we need to make sure that once we get this running, you're not facing staff turnover and staff shortages like everyone else. So I would like you to consider that in how much that you ask of us. I mean, I know there's another conversation about coming back with a proposal. I'm also aware of the cost of everything else. So in finding a person who will be employed by one organization, your staff and administrator, whether or not this contemplates that that person would have health insurance and other things which are really so important. I have to pay for my own health insurance. Thank God my employer pays me enough to afford it. But given that I pay $1,300 a month to have health insurance, I can imagine how that might hit someone unless they already have health insurance through a spouse or something else. So I want to make sure that you allow for that, and that's why I would like to have asked the city staff to have additional conversations with you about the amount of money that you ask from us. We tend to fund things, what I call a sliver. You know, yes, we want to participate in this effort. Let us give you this sliver of funding. This has been something that this community has needed for years. And so let's make sure it's successful, so that it will attract, if it's successful, it will attract support from other funders. Other employers will want to help. Faith-based communities want to help. Veterans United and the other foundations, Shelter Foundation perhaps, because there might be an education component, will want to help. But in the meantime, let's make sure that you are not struggling the first year to have everything you need to make this successful. So that's my pitch to our council members and to city staff, to come back to us with an amount that you're asking us for that takes those things into consideration. I want you to be wildly successful at this.
Thank you.
So that our folks who are able to go through training at Moberly Area Community College and Job Point can access those entry-level jobs that start at $17 an hour in the food manufacturing, but promise to pay in the 45s once they have gone through training. Because we need more people working at that level to be able to support their families in Columbia. So I don't know how, DeCarlin, do you need, I mean, of course you need some consensus from us that we want to make sure that the amount of money we fund to this assists them in that. I don't know, Barbara, how do we change, I mean, we have money, we have ARPA funds.
Right.
This falls within ARPA funds.
I think the direction that we give is for staff to work with Dr. Woods and others, and also our transportation staff and others, on coming up with what would that proposal look like, what is legally allowed, what is financially supported, what is in line, and come back before moving forward with it.
And that would be the idea.
Yeah, and I think, and to that, it's, yeah, thinking about it in this area. And then the other aspect I'm going to have, and this is bleeding into our ARPA discussion, is what are we doing also to assist with the capacity building so that the applicants are successful? Because, I mean, you know, when you say you're like, this is not my normal job, I mean, transportation is, but not doing this. So we want to make sure, if you want it to be successful, that they're also working with, like, our staff to know how to do that going forward. And then we probably need to move on.
I think it's incumbent for the staff to work with this. I have great confidence in the private sector to establish some sort of number and ask for matching funds that reflects some of their needs. And I think they've thought about this for some period of time. We may need to evaluate this in terms of making sure that it is a success, but at least initially, I think I have some confidence in those numbers that you suggested.
Yep. Thank you so much.
I can provide a revised proposal of what the city has.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Council. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Next up on is ARPA survey results, the results of a fantastic June campaign. It's like, who's Stephanie? You? Okay.
Love you.
Who gets the hot seat?
I'm going to introduce you to two more of my wonderful staff, actually three. Carrie Utterback, I think many people know Carrie.
Yes.
Jordan Bales, she's a new senior planner with the department, and they are leading this process. And then back here, Michelle Scheichels. Michelle has been our health promotion supervisor, just became our planning supervisor, was promoted to that position. And she's so dedicated as a city employee. She's here the night before, and she has her baby.
Oh, well, thank you. And if you need to leave, please go.
So I'm going to turn this over to Carrie and Jordan. They have a short presentation, and then we hope to have a good discussion.
Okay, thank you. And I'm going to try to, just a heads up while you guys are getting your stuff organized, probably try to stop us at 6:30 to move into our close, just to make sure we have enough time for that. So keep that in mind as we're getting closer.
Or sooner.
Okay.
You're good to go. Okay, good evening, everyone. My name is Jordan, and this is Carrie. Tonight, we will be sharing the results of the ARPA survey. We're really excited to go over this with you all, so let's go ahead and get started. So as you are aware, City Council has committed the first half of the ARPA funds, $12.6 million, to address community violence, homelessness, behavioral crisis care, mental health services, and workforce development. So our community engagement process centers around the second allocation of $12.6 million. Just as a little bit of a refresher, the broad eligible use categories for the ARPA funds are investments in water, sewer, and broadband infrastructure, governmental services up to the extent of revenue lost, premium pay for eligible workers, and public health and economic impacts. And I also wanted to note that each category includes assistance for impacted as well as disproportionately impacted classes. Impacted classes are those who experience the general broad-based impacts of the pandemic, while disproportionately impacted classes face meaningfully more severe impacts, often due to pre-existing disparities. So on to the purpose of the survey. The purpose of the survey was to identify these disproportionate impacts on individuals, households, businesses, and nonprofits, and to collect feedback regarding the community's prioritization of the remaining ARPA funds. So on the survey, respondents were asked to provide some basic demographic information, whether they live, work, and/or own a business in Columbia, how COVID-19 impacted their lives, businesses, and income as applicable, and lastly, how they would prioritize the allocation of the second half of ARPA funds. We had them select three options, but we did provide a write-in. So how did we get the word out? We adopted a comprehensive communication approach, which included a general awareness campaign delivered through multiple forms of media and social media, including Hulu, cable TV, Spotify, social media, and radio. We also utilized and promoted Be Heard Como as sort of a one-stop shop for information regarding the city's ARPA funds. We partnered with community leaders and organizations to reach those who didn't necessarily have regular internet access. So we actually had paper surveys available in English and Spanish at the Health Department, City Hall, the Library, the ARC, the Armory, the Food Bank on Big Bear, and we also handed out paper surveys and QR codes at a multitude of community events. We delivered multiple community e-newsletters with information delivered to those interested and asked them to share with their networks. We also had the survey translated into five languages, including Swahili, Pashto, Arabic, Spanish, and Burmese. And lastly, anyone could call 874-CITY and take the survey in any language over the phone. Okay, so I wanted to draw your attention to the handout that we handed out earlier. So this slide is an error. So we have some new slides for you all. So this shows a breakdown of Boone County respondents as well as respondents who are within the city of Columbia. So this, we have this breakdown due to the fact that we included respondents who don't necessarily live in Columbia but might work or own a business in Columbia. So although the chart shows that we were able to obtain the minimum sample size for representativeness for each category, and you can find that minimum in the middle row there, and then the bold is what the ARPA survey actually received, we wanted to make a note that the white population, both in Boone County and in the city of Columbia, was heavily oversampled. So for example, in Boone County, we needed 237 and we received 3,882. And for the city of Columbia, we needed 280, and we received 3,149. So we just wanted to draw attention to this to reiterate that we really want to hear from some of our other populations.
Yes. So the Boone County folks are not, the city of Columbia folks are not duplicated in the Boone County number. Those are two separate populations by zip code?
They are. So Boone County includes all of our respondents.
So the difference, if I subtract 4,068 from 4,470, do I get the what we assume is Boone County residents?
Like outside of the city, you mean?
Yes. Is that the difference? So there's like 300 people that, okay. And do you think that the Boone County residents were probably city staff that don't live in the city limits? We don't have any way of knowing.
That wasn't a question that was asked.
It wasn't a question to ask them if they were city staff. Okay. Okay. Thanks.
Sure. Okay. And then I also wanted to note on the population below poverty level, we have that defined as households earning below $35,000 of taxable income annually, and that is regardless of household size. Okay. So moving on to survey respondents, broken out by zip code. So there was not a survey question in this case about ward, and our thought process there was one that some of the respondents don't necessarily live within the city, so they don't have a ward. But the top respondents here were in 65203, 65202, and 65201. Any individuals who answered no to all three of the questions, so working, owning a business, or living in Columbia, we filtered out.
And the other, some of them fit into 65201, and then also it was people who lived in Callaway and
yes.
Audrey.
Callaway and Cole.
Callaway and Cole counties.
So the other there on the bottom, that little chunk of 72 is what she's referring to. So those are the people who wrote in zip codes. I think 10 or 11 of them actually wrote in zip codes that would fall into Boone County. And then the majority of the rest of them were Callaway and Cole County. Okay, here are the respondents broken out. Apologize. The respondents broken out by age. So we provided a write-in for age, as that's what the census does, but just for a little bit of a better ease of understanding, we put them in ranges on the back end. So as you can see, the 35 to 44 age group leads here. And here are the respondents broken out by gender identity. So you can see that female is in the lead here. I did want to note that we originally had asked for sex at birth. So when the survey was first published, it was just asking for sex at birth as male, female, and I believe we did include a self-identified write-in. So we received some really great feedback from the community, and pretty shortly afterwards, we changed it to gender identity. So we are actually working on a standardized list of demographic questions for future surveys so that we can be as inclusive as possible and also consistent. So we just took that as a really great learning opportunity. Here are the respondents as categorized by race. So as you can see here again, the white population is oversampled. I also wanted to note that if you add up all of these percentages, it does not equal 100, and that is because people were able to select multiple races, so for all of them. Here are those survey respondents by ethnicity. Non-Hispanic or non-Latino leads at 82.46%. with Hispanic and Latino at 2.26%. And I just wanted to make a note that those who are Hispanic and Latino account for 3.4% of Columbia's population, but again, only 2.26% of survey respondents. So we'll talk about focus group recommendations a little bit later, but we are definitely considering a Spanish-speaking focus group. Okay, so here are the survey respondents about household income. We did utilize ranges. So in the lead here, we have 100,000 to 149,999 annual taxable household income. The reason we utilized ranges and not write-ins were that we thought that people would be a little bit more comfortable answering a salary range rather than a write-in. We are also going to be recommending a focus group comprised of those who earn less than $35,000 a year. Okay, on to the priority rankings. So I know that this slide might be a little bit hard to read, so I'm just going to read the top five. So in number one, we have funding to help community members access health services, including mental health. Number two, investments in affordable housing. Number three, premium pay for workers. Number four, funding services for homeless residents. And number five, assistance to households. So like things like food, utility, rental, or cash assistance. I did want to mention, since other is relatively far up, so these were the write-ins. We received 924 responses. We saw a lot of write-ins regarding like road repair, some write-ins about roll cards and things like that. Here are the rankings. We thought that it would be important to show the rankings of our Black, Indigenous, and people of color populations. So we see here that assistance to households ranks number one, followed by investments in affordable housing, funding services for homeless residents, funding to help community members access health services, including mental health, and funding to address food insecurity. Here we have the priority rankings of those classified as low income. Again, we defined this as earning less than $35,000 annually. And these respondents' top five priorities are actually the same as the previous slide. So we have assistance to households, investments in affordable housing, funding services for homeless residents, funding to help community members access health services, and funding to address food insecurity. So this graphic kind of summarizes the last three slides. We thought that this was a nice way to visualize the priorities in the last three categories. So as you can see, like I mentioned, the Black, Indigenous, and People of Color group and the low-income group have the same top five priorities. And when you consider all respondents, they are a little bit different. We do have affordable housing as number two for everyone, but all respondents include premium pay and do not include food insecurity in their top five.
Can we ask questions along the way?
Yeah, if you guys are okay.
Okay. On low income, I see that you defined it for $35,000 annually, but were you able to consider a household size in that? Probably not, in my mind.
Right. So we did ask a question about household size, but because we provided the income in ranges, we were unable to actually calculate the federal poverty level. So for a household size of one, if they were to earn $35,000, that's around 250%, and around 200% would qualify them for most services, at least at the federal government.
Yeah. Yeah.
And almost all the households were between one and three. So,
oh, really?
Almost all of the households. We have very few over three people in the household.
Okay.
Yeah. Hmm. That'll be in the full report, but I can send it to you.
Okay, so we have the priority rankings now filtered for those who live in Columbia, but may or may not work in Columbia. So, the top rankings are pretty similar to the overall rankings, with the exception of premium pay. So in number one, we have funding to access health services, including mental health, investments in affordable housing, funding services for homeless residents, assistance to households, investments in sewer and water infrastructure, and funding to address food insecurity. Here we have the priority rankings of those who do not live in Columbia but work in Columbia. So the number one for these respondents was premium pay for workers, assistance to small businesses and nonprofits, funding for workforce development, funding to help community members access health services, including mental health, and investments in sewer and water infrastructure. And because other ranked relatively high, I wanted to give just a couple of kind of themes that we were seeing there. We were seeing a lot of premium pay specifically for first responders, EMT, police, fire, And then we also saw a lot of write-ins for roads or other general infrastructure. Okay, and now I believe I will hand it over to Carrie.
Okay, so Jordan mentioned that we asked for zip code, and so this is just a map of our zip codes for 65201, 202, and 203. So for 201, we had funding to help community members access health services, including mental health as number one, funding services for homeless residents as number two, investments in affordable housing as number three, and then direct assistance to households as number four, and premium pay as number five. Funding to help community members access health and mental health is going to be the number one for all three zip codes. One of the survey comments was a large centralized facility for the homeless to provide shelter, showers, laundry facilities, clothes, food, and mental health support / life coach support programs. So 65202, you'll notice funding for mental health at the top again is health and mental health, but you'll notice that food insecurity didn't rank in the top. And water sewer didn't rank in the top, whereas they did in 65203. So number two is premium pay, number three is assistance to households, four being investments in affordable housing, and five being funding services for homeless residents. So some of the comments we saw from here were funding to assist middle-class working semi-retired people struggling with buying food, gas, emergency expenses, to include car, medical, dental, due to price increases and no increase in income. And there used to be a coupon program through CPS and a local clothing pantry that would help parents buy new shoes for their kids twice a year. That program was so helpful, and I haven't seen anything like that anywhere else we live and haven't had the program since before the pandemic. Parents need that back. So 65203, you'll notice, was by far the largest number of people that responded. So theirs were funding to help community members access health and mental health, investments in affordable housing, investments in sewer and water, funding services for homeless residents, and funding to address food insecurity. So 65203 didn't rank premium pay in the top six, where the other two did. But 65203 is also the only one to rank food insecurity and sewer and water infrastructure. So some quotes were renewable housing resources, new build and rehab of old homes in subsidized microloans, not land trusts, that are paid back at next to nothing interest rates to create an ongoing pool of resources to develop more housing of the same nature. And then release restrictions on farmers and growers to allow selling of goods and food in personal vehicles. Lift some merchant licensures or vendor restrictions for growers, bakers, and farmers to sell out of POV in neighborhoods. Assist such with funding to accept food coupons, vehicle needs, background checks, etc. This may help growers, farmers, as well as those who can't afford to have groceries delivered or transportation available. Perhaps setting up with the farmers markets. So this is very similar to the last one that you saw, except this one is by zip code. So you'll notice health and mental health at the top in every one. But you'll notice premium pay only made it into two categories, and then sewer and water and food insecurity only made it into that one category of 65203. So the next question on the survey is, how has your income been negatively impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic? So for all participants, what ranked pretty high was did not impact my income negatively. Next would be reduction in wages due to temporary layoffs or reduced hours, and then other, and then permanently lost my position. So some of the other responses included, they mentioned inflation or cost of living, like 162 people mentioned one of those. Some mentioned the loss of a business or loss of sales causing a reduction in income or a reduction in income for some other reason. And then some mentioned an inability to hire or other issues with staffing.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Carrie, Nick has a question.
Yes, go ahead.
Do you have that by zip code?
We
impacts on income.
We could. I don't have a slide for it, but we could get it for you.
Yeah, I think especially with the higher participation in 203, that it might be helpful to see.
Yeah, we can definitely get that to you.
Okay.
We will note that. Okay, thank you so much. We do have the breakouts for Black, Indigenous, people of color, and for low income for this breakout, and they were slightly different. This one had COVID-19 did not impact my income, reduction in wages due to temporary staff, other, and then permanently lost my position. Examples of other include increased expenses due to inflation, having to close a business, or even miss work because of COVID. So on our low income population, again, this is less than 35,000 annually, would be reduction in wages due to temporary layoff or reduced hours is number one. And then COVID did not impact my income negatively, then other, then permanently lost my positions. And examples of other were increased cost, monetary and emotional stress due to disability of self or a family member. So next question was, what has been your biggest challenge in recovering from the COVID-19 pandemic? And respondents could select all that apply. So for everyone, for all participants, health, mental health, depression, anxiety was number one. And then emotional isolation was number two. Emotional fear of illness or being around others was number three. Financial, reduction in income or loss of employment, number four. Number five being none of those. Number six, financial, new debt due to the pandemic. Number seven, other. Eight, emotional grief. And then emotional, loss of a loved one, health, recovery from illness, finding a job. And then lastly, financial, medical debt due to COVID-19. Examples of other included inflation, mistrust of the government, and emotional stress. So if we look specifically at our Black, Indigenous, people of color population here, we see mental health, depression, anxiety being number one, emotional isolation being number two, emotional fear of illness, being around others, number three, financial reduction in income, loss of employment, number four, financial new debt due to the pandemic, then emotional loss of a loved one, emotional grief, then that's down quite a lot for none of the above. Health, recovery from illness, other, financial and medical debt due to COVID-19, and then finding a job was the last one. Examples of other included cost of living, stress, and frustration with government.
And Carrie, I'm just being mindful of our time. You have 10 more slides, and just wanted, we have about 20 minutes, I just want to make sure.
Okay.
Doing okay?
Yes.
Okay.
So, are you wanting me to skip to the end?
Well, I mean, just some of the things, right? I think you're going to provide us with a report of the responses, it sounds like.
Yes.
So for some of those additional details, I think if we have specific questions, but also the discussions about next steps, I think are of interest.
So we have to be done at 6:30?
Well, I just know we need to go to closed session.
At 6:30?
Well, I don't have a specific time, but that was the goal.
Okay. I like a goal.
That's your, yeah.
Okay.
The chances of us meeting that goal, knowing us, meh.
Yeah,
please,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, so for low income, it was a lot the same, but you'll notice finding a job bumped up, and then none of the above is definitely way down there. This is for businesses that have been negatively impacted. A lot of people had increased cost. A lot of people had reduction in income. And again, this is everyone. And then there was a reduction in their workforce during COVID-19. COVID-19 did not impact their business's income or other, or they had to permanently close their business. And other included inflation, cost of living, government shutdowns, child care, school education issues, health, staffing loss of business, COVID isn't real, no one wants to work, those kind of responses were also in other. For our Black, Indigenous, people of color, definitely increased cost, and then reduction in income. Those were almost simultaneous. And then only four said permanently closed business. Example of other, which is number four, were temporary closings, paying employees or issues with staffing, and higher rent or inflation. For our low-income folks who owned a business, the reduction in income was number one, increased cost number two, then you have reduction in workforce, other, COVID-19 did not impact my income, and then business permanently closed. In the other category, we had reduction in hours, capacity, cost of products, working or meeting remotely, and then building rent cost. So while we're really here is to get on to what's next after the survey. So the survey can only give us a certain amount of information, that kind of quantitative data. And so now we're ready to move on to that more qualitative data. So we need to dive deeper into why those three priorities rose to the top and get into how we can do that with those that were most disproportionately affected by COVID. So what we would like to do is continue this needs assessment process by conducting focus groups. We need to construct their next report, so it will not only include what's in the survey, but also the what's going to be in the focus groups. We will present. We're happy to present that to council by September 30th. We would also love to make sure that the needs assessment that we or the report that we put together of those needs can not only be used in ARPA but also in any strategic plan priorities, but all of those other things that we have going on as well. And then work with finance on funding allocations and the next phase of implementation. So I'm going to skip that one for just a second and go to our suggested timeline. So we've already done the survey, and now we are ready to conduct focus groups in August and September and make that report. And so then hopefully in October, you would then be able to select the priority areas that you are ready to fund and then work with finance on the RFP process. And that gets to accepting submissions and proposals into January and then having the proposals reviewed and recommendations for funding provided, you know, by March, and then getting those funds to be allocated by next summer. So I know that it seems very quick and also a long ways away if you're an organization who's struggling. So we would like to, in the February report, we Health brought you a proposal and a budget for 10 focus groups, about 7 in person and 3 virtual. And so you've already approved the budget for these for gift cards, childcare, and food. So we have, based on the gaps identified through the survey, we would like to put together groups of people and then work with conveners actually to help us get those 10 to 15 group together. It gives us a way to communicate. It gives us more trust with that community and allows us to focus on the data portion and allowing our conveners to help us build within that community and get their stories and truths out to get to that kind of qualitative data piece that we're trying to get to. And then the virtual ones, it will actually be an option for the focus group. Would you like to meet in person or would you like to meet virtually? Whatever's easiest for you. We understand that virtual is easier for some people and much, much harder for others. So it would be up to the focus group on how they want to participate. So here is kind of the groups that we have thought through based on, I think Jordan talked a little bit about who's been disproportionately impacted, so those populations, but also in some of the priorities that were identified in the survey. So we would like to have a focus group with our Black African American population, individuals that speak Spanish, local refugee populations that actually was shown through the very few amount of people who utilized those other languages in taking the survey. Individuals with disabilities, households making less than $35,000 annually, those impacted by health and mental health issues, health and mental health professionals. I'm going to skip housing cost burden for just a second. Local businesses that were impacted, and then local nonprofits, because that's kind of what ARPA is more focused on. So coming back to housing cost burden, we would really love to have an affordable housing kind of focus group, but there's a lot of work already going on with affordable housing. So we don't want to duplicate work, and it seems like Randy and his crew have really already kind of convened some of those focus groups, and so we don't want to duplicate that work. So we would just kind of like to talk to people who are housing cost burden and in need of more affordable housing, as opposed to those who have already talked to the first kind of ARPA fund group that's already working, if that makes sense. So that's why it's labeled as housing cost burden, because we're hoping to get a different group of people. So we're really hoping to delve deeper into why the top three priorities rose to the top, and get progress on those. And then we would also really like to, in that next report, make sure that we have the qualitative data that you can get from focus groups that you just can't get from a survey. Okay, so now that we've talked, we are ready for you to talk. Okay, what questions can we answer?
Questions for staff.
Yes, ma'am.
Any idea how many without internet access you were able to survey?
You mean just with paper copies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I assume that's the only other way it was able to be done.
Well, so they could also call
or by phone. Well, that, but you wouldn't necessarily know that they didn't have internet access.
We wouldn't know if they called in, but we could get paper number.
Paper, it was several hundred.
Okay.
I could get the exact number. Absolutely.
Okay.
And I think our most surveys collected was at the public library.
Yes, absolutely. Yep.
Okay.
Okay, perfect. That would be great if we could add that to the report, Stephanie. Thank you so much.
And did I miss it, or is there a ranking of priorities by income? I know you have a low income, but I'm wondering if that's broken out.
You mean like out of each individual income range and what their priorities were?
Or groups of income range or something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, we only did low income.
Okay.
But we can.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we
I would
can
think
filter for that.
The data, you can
mm-hmm.
sort it.
So if you're interested in the people who made over $35,000 and what their priorities were, we could look into that.
Okay. Well, I have to say, while I love this data and I think it's helpful, my one ongoing concern, which I know you're looking to address here, is that it was heavily weighted white. My guess
yes.
is heavily weighted in upper incomes.
Oh, yeah. No,
and
we
so,
do. It is heavily weighted in income.
Yeah.
Yes.
So when we're talking about addressing the needs of those who've been most impacted by the pandemic, of course, that's going to be people, more likely to be people with low income.
Yes.
And those
so
if we
did have a slide for that, but
yeah.
not anybody, oh gosh, that's the wrong button. But not for any income, just the low income folks.
Okay.
Do you know what slide that is?
It's okay. I don't
yeah.
think you need to go there.
Okay.
I
was going to say, I know we have it by income, and I know that's one of the ones Jordan talked about. So, yeah, just priority rankings, just low income,
mm-hmm.
are different. Actually, it might be helpful. This is the one that's, I think, most helpful.
Yes.
Is that when we look at our Black, Indigenous, people of color respondents and our low income respondents, they said the exact same thing that they needed.
Okay.
So,
So if you're taking suggestions on inputs to what you're going to send out to us in terms of report, to Nick's point, maybe something showing how over or under represented some of those demographics are. I think you mentioned race and gender. So, you know, so comparing the survey results to, I guess, census data, if that's what you're using, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So on the focus groups, on that list that you had there at the end, some of those, I mean, are you going to be asking people to sort of volunteer or self-identify as being in those groups? Or how will you?
So our idea is to get conveners. So, so we would have local people in the community getting 10 to 15 people together that have been impacted example might be that we had a case investigator who spoke Spanish, is involved in the local Spanish-speaking community. We might ask her if she's willing to come help us facilitate a focus group.
Okay.
Yeah. To identify individuals and.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking specifically about those impacted by health and mental health issues, you know, whether, you know, they would be willing to come forward or how exactly you would do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I know, so you gave us results on a, you know, for a couple of those groups. And, you know, you talked about how they were, you know, different than like the overall results. So, you know, I'm thinking forward to, you know, whatever you come back with in terms of the qualitative aspect to this. Just thinking about how we should reconcile sort of the overall survey data with, you know, what you come back with, since, right, there's differences there. I don't know if that's something to answer.
Are you
or
asking
not.
How they reconcile?
Yeah.
And how they you know, when you're talking, I mean, they are different sorts of data. So how does one, how what will be your process for identifying how each compares with the other, I guess? Is that pretty close?
Or what we should take from that, you know, looking at different results.
So again, ARPA is really specific, and they want you to make the most impact with the people who were most impacted by COVID. And we know that the people who are most impacted by COVID were oftentimes the ones who didn't have paid time off. They couldn't afford another child care provider. They didn't have anyone to watch their kids. So I'm not saying that isn't in this all population, but we know that white middle to upper class people were overrepresented in this all population. And so we really focused on these other populations and what they said they needed.
And it might help then when you're providing that data, like to Nixon, you know, to show the additional for, like, those are some of the rankings for high above 35,000, right? Because it's above that is, I think, the question.
It's like very much above that. Like, I think
the number one was, I think, 100.
Yeah, 100 to 149.
It was really very much way above poverty. Here it is. Sorry, household income. So you're looking at 100 to 150, and 50 to 75 being the highest, but also then that 75 to 100 is number three. So really, they're over surveyed quite a bit.
Do we have census data on this also?
Yeah, we can get that.
Yeah.
It's on
this.
It is on this.
Okay.
And I think the intent as well, besides the I'm looking at the color, what page is this? 17, slide 17 is the one that has the color comparisons.
Yeah.
You know, I think what we're talking about is the remaining trench of ARPA funds. And so it's not saying that some of the other aspects are not on the table. This is just more of like when thinking about, because it was harder for us to have people, like to decide how people were going to do, what can we do to benefit people and humans on this. And I think this is where we're going from it. So it's not saying that programs that are thinking about other impacts of the pandemic are not already receiving funds. I think about some of the workforce development projects we're doing with MACC and just some of those things that are going forward, we're going to see those replicated. We're going to see those impact for more people. The one question I had on the focus groups was one of the respondents you had that was kind of that qualitative response back is what it sounded like some of the other ones was, is the school district also doing some of these school-age children, those, you know, who responded, you know, that they lost income because they had to quit because of childcare, or businesses lost workforce because they had to quit because of childcare. Is that one of the areas that we're looking to talk to, or are we hoping we'll capture that conversation in some of those other pieces?
So we would love to move forward with 10, and we are happy to move forward with more than 10, but we would have to push the timeline.
Okay.
So if you will, we can obviously add more or subtract one and add one, but if we add more, the report is probably going to come a little later just
right.
Because qualitative data is so difficult to quantify.
So maybe then for part of that, it's that questions when you're asking your convener. Also, it's beneficial for us to hear from families of school-age children who were impacted by this, or local nonprofits. If one of the things was asking us about a transportation example, you know what I mean? Like, just to know about.
Yeah.
I just one of the values I think of this other data, this qualitative data, and going out and having small groups and going to folks and giving them childcare and a meal and so on and so forth, is that you often realize emergent leadership, people who are not the folks that always show up at city council meetings and whatever, if you can bring that to them, there are usually some superstars that wind up that really can talk to these issues with personal experience. So I like this model. And I think this model has been successful in the past, and I anticipate it may be successful in the future.
Pat, I was waiting to see if Betsy had any questions.
No.
Okay, I have a couple. So the first thing is the housing cost burdened folks.
Yes.
I have attended one of the meetings where everybody who cares about people who are housing cost burdened were there, but people who were housing cost burdened were not. So I know that at any given time, we have 200 vouchers out there through the various organizations that would help people with income supports for housing, but they can't find housing. That's the group I'm most interested in hearing from.
The people with vouchers who can't get the bill?
The people who can't find a place to live.
Okay.
Who are have everything else in their life. Steve, there was a priority list. Right? Steve Hollis here. He has such good vocabulary for this. So Steve, there was a meeting and he was sitting right here and he said, these are folks that have been screened, they're ready for housing, they have the capacity to maintain stable housing, but there's no place for them to go. Those folks will have insights that the rest of us won't. And so if you can drill down when you get to housing cost burden there, because again, I mean, I loved every minute of that meeting we had out at Broadway Christian Church, but I was surrounded by all the people I volunteer with, not with the people I serve. So that's my first one. The other one, those impacted by mental health and mental health issues, I mean, we're going to hear from our mutual aid folks tonight, who are the folks that talk most often to the folks that have untreated mental health issues that are living on our streets. You know best because this is your area of expertise about how you use. I'm concerned about too much of a filter in the information we get from them. I mean, we need people to come alongside them to make them feel safe to have those conversations, but we need to hear from them and not from necessarily the folks that work with them. So, and I think the mutual aid community would be willing to be helpful to you all in that, not as a convener, but maybe as to come alongside and help. So I would like to recommend that as well. And then it is not lost on me, you have to go back to another slide, that there are folks that responded with premium pay. And those would have to be city employees because they would be the only ones eligible that we could give premium pay to. Oh, you could give it to anybody in the community. Okay.
You give it to somebody who works at a grocery store or...
Okay. So I would like to suggest that we not disregard that. Now, I am also aware, several people sent me social media posts from our collective bargaining units that they were out encouraging people to select that when they did the ARPA survey. And there was lots of specific information. Go to the ARPA survey and be sure to say this. So I admire their social media skills. We all wish that we had the same abilities. But rather than ignore that conversation and have that conversation always running around in the background, I think we need a way to address that. What struck me early on where our city employees are concerned, and I spoke to both city managers about this, is that some of our folks make it work working for the city because they have a second job. And their hours, and they figured out that delicate balance of how to do this and this. But during COVID, the second job went away. They lost those extra hours, which is how they made their lives work for themselves and their kids and everyone else. Whether they're a firefighter, whether or not they're a police officer doing extra duty, which all of those things evaporated during COVID. There was no special events they could work. Whether they're a trash collector that also cleans, you know, school buildings at night, but school buildings were closed, so there went their custodial job that they did in the small hours in the morning.
I want us to hear those stories as well.
Of frontline workers and not just city employees.
Of you all have been, I was not aware that we could use premium pay across the board, but of folks, frontline workers, of folks who had those kind of hardships and who, again, you know, they I remember when I used to have to work two jobs. At one time I had three jobs in Columbia. And if any one of those other two went away after my day job, I would be more well-rested than I was with having these two other jobs. But my household was going to collapse. I would not be able to pay my bills. That's an enormous amount of stress.
So Pat,
how you convene a focus group to look into that, because we did have a high number of people that responded with premium pay, regardless of what motivated them to do it. Let's not ignore that. Let's not have that lobbying going on in the side without our understanding what the real needs are there. That's my point.
Yeah, so there's a couple of potential additional focus groups, right? People with kids, because I think, you know, thinking on it, it would be ideal, like, just to have that, you know, because if we need to start looking into doing programs or creating services that are, because if this happens again or we have a natural disaster, I want to be able that we already have the bones in place to help support people. And then to Pat's point, and I'm also looking to y'all to think about this, like, I don't know whether or not I want to take one away or add one or what that is. I kind of trust, I want your feedback on that as well and whether or not it's adding or taking away. But one with people with kids and then those who could utilize the premium pay, definitely, you know what I mean? So if it's thinking about grocery workers, firefighters, trash collectors, whatever, I mean, just to know what does that look like and to hear those stories.
So I wrote this down. How is premium pay defined? And was it defined? I took the survey. Was it defined in the survey? So when people had an opportunity.
I have the survey. It's like they handed it out to us just a second.
Oh. Matthew's here. Matthew, how do you talk about premium pay?
So.
And then I'm mindful over time.
Yeah.
Marty, over. Just keep going. I'll look it over. Go ahead.
Premium pay can be paid to homeless. There's an eligible list, and then there
You know, I honestly don't know if we need that definition now. Really, what I was getting at was what the impact of a survey had in terms of getting that information. And premium pay is not defined here. So it may be one of the more elusive items in the survey for people to understand.
So it's two parts, eligible worker and essential work. The essential work piece, you had to be in NC, whatever they mean, not virtual. The eligible worker piece, for us, it would, government employees in general are eligible, so it would be basically for the city, it would be all government employees that were here and not working virtual. That's what it would mean for the city. Outside of that, you have people that were doing essential work. Critical infrastructure sectors, public health, people who are dealing with the public that may have had it, dealing with the public's paperwork. So it's pretty broad.
Right? Okay. Well, what do y'all think about, I don't know what you want to suggest to Carlin, whether or not it's thinking about, because I understand your point, Carrie, about it affecting your timeline, and I know we want to get this out sooner.
It's your
later.
Timeline.
But, right, it's appropriated by the end of 23 and spent by the end of 24, so.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I got an extra year. All right.
But we're always under this gun about doing things as expeditiously as possible and yet doing it with due diligence. So there is always that trade-off.
Yeah.
I think if you want to look at the premium pay, and if you want to look at the families, I would just add them as two additional. I wouldn't take away from what you have.
Yeah.
So I think because what you have are things that we that that shows a disparity, and then these are things that we really need to target.
Yeah.
So if we added two of those, would that just add like another month rather than the end of September? Would you think the end of October would be reasonable to add those two?
I think so.
Okay.
Are you guys okay with those extras? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. Thank you so much.